is knowing. Crow!
All right, Mal, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 570. Jason Lingren is with me, and for the first time, Michael Palmer is joining us. We were very happy to meet Michael. He took a scrutinizing look at the claimed nuke drop on Japan, specifically Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He has written a book about it. Everybody should write this down if you have an interest. The name of the book is Hiroshima Revisited, and that's from 2022. It is Michael Palmer. You spell it just how it sounds. Welcome, Jason.
And a lovely good morning.
All right. Welcome for the first time, Michael. I'm glad to have you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here and to have the opportunity to speak about the subject.
Okay, thank you. Michael, just to start us off, can you give us just a little background on your education level? I know you're a medical doctor, but would you like to add anything beyond that?
Right. So I'm a medical doctor, and as you might guess from my accent, I'm from Germany. I got my medical degree at the University of Gießen. After that, I worked for 10 years in the Medical Research Institute, Institute of Medical Microbiology at the University of Mainz. And after that, I took a position as a professor of biochemistry at a Canadian university, from which I was fired in 2022 for refusing the COVID jab.
Ah, good for you. Probably saved your own life. All right, Jason, do you have anything you want to add in before we start?
It is absolutely awesome that someone is coming at this from a scientific point of view.
Right. This is going to be quite different than the work I have done to demonstrate that I do not accept the existence of nuclear weapons as described. We're going to get into things all the way down to the measurement of isotopes, which proves things. But Michael, why don't you go ahead and pick up? How did you get on this trail? What led you to begin to doubt or to investigate the supposed nuclear bombardment of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Right. So I think I go back a little bit further than that. I only in 2016 actually woke up to the reality of what really had happened at New York on September 9th, 2001. And what really shocked me when I stumbled upon a video of World Trade Center 7 collapsing onto itself, just like a very nice, pretty, well-executed, controlled demolition. And that really shocked me out of my trance. And I thought, if to this day, politics and media still pretend that the fairy tale about the terror attacks by some Islamic terrorists is true, then what else is false? So I actually started quite aggressively to go down all manner of rabbit holes. And one day I stumbled into the internet on the assertion, and I don't even recall anymore where I actually found it the first time, that the nukes in Japan had not been real, that there had been no atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the evidence presented there looked quite compelling to me. And then on the other hand, I looked at the scientific literature. And in the scientific literature, you find all manner of studies that claim to support the official story that indeed nuclear bombings had occurred there. So I thought to myself, I really have to sort this out. I have to get to the bottom of it. And then I started just collecting all manner of studies, all manner of references, books, scientific papers, eyewitness accounts, and so on, in order to really understand what had occurred or hadn't occurred in these two cities. So I just want to make it clear that's the topic of my expertise. I really haven't spent any amount of time on looking into what is up with nuclear weapons nowadays. I really have no in-depth insight into that topic. So I'm really only competent to speak about Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Do you think that the narrative is being shaken a bit, which is why they did this massive movie that, as a movie, was actually quite good with Oppenheimer?
I have not seen that movie. It is one possible interpretation is indeed that this is just intended to shore up the official narrative, to simply drown out any criticism with this sort of reinforcement. On the other hand, one might wonder if there's any sort of predictive programming at work here again, right? I mean, you know that this movie Pearl Harbor came out a couple of months before 9/11. So I'm just wondering whether they want to prepare us for the use of some sort of weapons of mass destruction, not necessarily nukes. I mean, there may be others. I mean, for example, chemical weapons do exist and have been used in warfare. Biological weapons exist and have been used in warfare. Nukes apparently have not been used in warfare. So they might just use these nukes because that was their primary terror tale. They just might reckon that using nukes will be a stronger scarecrow than anything to do with chemical or biological weapons.
Well, there's a few interesting things. I have covered nukes extensively, and I have stated for the record that I do not accept that nuclear weapons exist as described. I do not accept that they've ever blown up cities. And I do not accept the whole narrative that has been laid down around it, to the point where I went back and I began to review all the supposed nuclear blast footage. And there are some very simple tells that put someone on the path. As an example, we've all been conditioned to consider that when we see a mushroom cloud, what we're seeing is a nuclear weapon going off. As a matter of fact, when I was in the Marine Corps, it was done. You're instructed and taught and trained what to do when you see the mushroom cloud. But here's the problem. Any sufficient explosion of a quick burning explosive element will create a mushroom cloud. You could have a mushroom cloud that's smaller than, you know, a building from just typical detonations. Then as I went along, I found other things along the way. Like there's a movie called Harakiri from, I think, 1962 or 73. The runtime of that movie is 133 minutes. And the reason I mention it is because we've shown how the fingerprints are numerically often encoded in things. But in this movie, which was released very close to September 11, the release dates seem to be jumbled around. One of the samurais walks in and he talks about being a Ronin from one of the World War II nuke cities. I think it's Hiroshima. It's either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And then he states he's from the Fukushima prefecture, which I know this isn't going to be within the scope of what we talked about, but this is media messing with our subconsciousness. So to pull it back around to the work that you specifically did on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where did you start to find reasons to doubt what you were being told? What were the things that you stumbled across that got you going?
Okay. So the very first thing I found was the eyewitness testimony by Alexander de Seversky. That's actually fairly widely cited on the internet. You may have found out about it as well. So this guy, he was a Russian fighter pilot in World War One, but he then moved after World War One, after the Russian Revolution. He moved to the United States and became a very successful aeronautical engineer. Okay. And he had contacts with the US government. So after World War II, in the months after World War II, he was sent around a world tour, or the tour of Germany and Japan, by the U.S. Secretary of Defense at the time, Patterson, and he was charged with simply compiling an expert report on the effects of the bombs that had been dropped on the various cities. And he states very clearly in one of his books that Hiroshima and Nagasaki looked exactly, they showed exactly the same signs of destruction as the conventionally bombed cities. And he really also expresses his wonderment about it. So he had been prepared to expect something totally different, and then he found exactly the same as in the other Japanese bombed out cities. And he also says that he visited the spot, the so-called hypocenter, right, which is the spot directly underneath the detonation, and he didn't find anything special there either. There were no signs of complete and utter destruction. There were still the residues of buildings standing and this sort of thing. And he points out that this simply doesn't add up with the usual narrative. So that was the very first thing I stumbled upon. Then I became interested in the studies on radiation, right? So the bombs, the radiation of the bomb is twofold, right? So you have the immediately released intense gamma and neutron radiation, right? Just as the bomb goes off, right? This supposed strong pulse of radiation is supposed to hit the ground and also hit the people and kill them quickly. And you also have radioactive fallout, right? So the nuclear chain reaction is supposed to release all manner of fission products, right? So one uranium nucleus gets fissioned into two different nuclei, sometimes three. And you have then these radioactive isotopes that are formed in this manner. They should simply drop to the ground and be found there. So there are indeed a number of fallout studies, both on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They are actually more numerous in Hiroshima. So a lot more research has gone into analyzing the bomb detonation in Hiroshima than at Nagasaki. And if you look closely at this fallout, there are two things that are really striking. The first is the amounts are exceedingly small, absolutely tiny. And just for illustration, you all know that in the 50s and 60s, additional nuclear detonations happened, right? So-called bomb tests, and the fallout, radioactive fallout from these bomb tests spread all over the globe, particularly the Northern Hemisphere. And even if you take soil samples from Hiroshima itself, okay, you actually find more radioactivity left behind by those bomb tests than by the original Hiroshima bomb.
Can I just jump in for a second? That's a bit confusing because it implies that there was actually a nuclear explosion that created harmful radiation in the tests, which migrated everywhere. And yet, I guess what I'm hearing... Well, okay, go ahead.
Okay. No, I do believe that some sort of nuclear detonations actually did happen in these tests. Something happened. I mean, even if it was conventionally blown up radioactive waste, but in these bomb tests, the very least you have to acknowledge is that in some manner, radioactivity was spread. Okay.
At harmful levels or minuscule levels?
Well, that's a good question. The levels would probably have been harmful if you had been close to the detonation. I mean, there's actually another sign of these detonations having happened, actual nuclear detonations having happened. I found a couple of studies from the early 1950s from America, and these concerned a couple of American soldiers who had been looking at these nuclear detonations from several miles away. And they actually had clear lesions in their retinas. Okay, so they had burns, they had clear, sharp burns in the retinas, right underneath the retinal image of the detonation. So you look at it, right? And similar, I mean, you are always warned to not look at the eclipse of the sun. Okay, the reason is that if you have this one bright spot illuminating one spot on your retina, then you can get a burn there. But the same can happen with these nuclear blasts. And it actually does seem to have happened to a number of American soldiers. Now, a separate question is, I mean, it's not so difficult to imagine how you could fake a nuclear detonation. Okay? All you have to do is build a reactor and put it into a strong casing and let it go.
So almost like a dirty bomb, you mean?
It is similar to a dirty bomb, if you will. But the power... So the explosive power can really come from the nuclear reaction itself, but it is not a real nuclear bomb, right? I mean, a real nuclear bomb like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I mean, the idea there is that you have one critical mass of highly enriched bomb fuel, either uranium or plutonium, and then you set off the chain reaction, and the chain reaction proceeds, it builds so fast that it envelopes the entire critical mass before it has time to blow apart. And this then, right, then you have all these already fissioned uranium atoms, right, in the thing, and then actually the blast occurs, it just blows itself up. And that has never really been demonstrated to actually work.
Well, don't you actually have evidence based on people who were in whatever it was, the Manhattan Project, where they make statements after the fact that they still don't have enough of the enriched materials needed? And I'll point out another thing before you speak. In the movie Oppenheimer, part of the narrative trying to convince you that the nukes were real is they get this jar with marbles And every time they throw in a marble, that's supposed to be a little more enriched material that they have. So they're basically in the movie addressing what you're about to prove, pretty much demonstrates they couldn't have had fissionable material.
Well, yes, there is indeed evidence that they didn't have. There is documentary evidence that they didn't have fissionable material in 1945. That is correct. And it is actually, this was stated on the record by Arthur Compton, the physics chief of the Manhattan Project, right? Novelist Arthur Compton, famous physicist. He was overseeing the entire physics research of the Manhattan Project, and he stated on the record on May 31st, 1945, that they had not succeeded in purifying plutonium at all. They didn't have any purified plutonium at that point. And he estimated that developing the process of purification would take another 2 years, and the accumulation of sufficient purified plutonium for building a bomb would take some more time after that. So it is absolutely impossible that they would have had the plutonium bomb ready 6 weeks later for this fable test in New Mexico, or also for the bomb drop in Nagasaki a few weeks after that. So he explicitly states this for plutonium. But if you read the protocol of the meeting with open eyes, you see that it also implies that they couldn't possibly have had enough enriched uranium for building the Hiroshima bomb. But Compton actually claims in that meeting that uranium bombs, plural, are already in production. The official narrative is that only one uranium bomb of the Hiroshima type was ever constructed. But in that protocol, Compton says they have already produced several of these bombs. Or these bombs are currently in production, suggesting they already have several, and obviously they have plans for making more than one. That is clearly a lie. It just simply doesn't jibe with the other scientific information in that memo.
Why in the heck would this man stand up after the fact, after they've told the world that they nuked a city, and openly admit that they didn't have the purified fissionable materials?
Well, it was before the bomb drops, and the statements were made before a secret committee in Washington. It was not public. It was not publicly stated.
Okay.
It was the so-called interim committee, and I think he told this meeting that they were already in the process of producing uranium bombs to fool some of the attending politicians. Okay, there were some politicians in attendance. So I think that even Truman himself, I believe, was most likely fooled about the real state of things in the Manhattan Project. It seems from Stimson, who was the Secretary of Defense during that time, right? He also seems to have been fooled. So they seem to have been fooled about the availability of atomic bombs. So Truman seems to really have believed that he had ordered the drop of an atomic bomb on Japan, and that it actually was an atomic bomb.
Well, let me ask you. So you've mentioned isotopes. So if, in fact, fissionable material actually existed, and they had enough purified whatever, uranium, plutonium, whatever it is they need, and they detonated it as a nuclear weapon, wouldn't that be a very specific isotope that could be measured after the fact?
Okay, so just to make this clear, right? So they didn't have enough purified bomb material in 1945, but they later on learned how to properly purify and enrich uranium. They actually learned this from the Russians. We might actually get into that.
Okay,
so in 1945, they didn't have it. But indeed, as you say, if the uranium bomb in Hiroshima had been real, we should actually expect a different composition of the fallout than we actually see. The mixture of the radioactive isotopes on the ground in Hiroshima clearly indicates that this fallout, or this radioactive material which was dispersed there, came from a reactor and not from a nuclear detonation. And the difference is this. It's a little bit lengthy, the explanation, so just bear with me. So we have natural uranium that consists of two major isotopes. One is uranium-238, that's the heavier one. It is not suitable as such as material for a fission bomb. And we have the minor one, that's uranium-235. That is the bomb fuel, and that accounts for only 0.7% of natural uranium. For building a fission bomb, even if it worked, it would have to be enriched to 80% of the total, right? So you enrich it about 100-fold, and you reduce the amount of the heavier atom from almost 100% to about 20%. So you reduce it by about 5-fold, okay? So for a reactor, you typically enrich the uranium-235 only slightly. You don't necessarily have to enrich it at all, but if you do enrich it, you enrich it to something like 3%. Okay, what's the significance of that? If you fission a uranium-235 nucleus in a bomb, it releases, apart from the fission products, it also releases a couple of neutrons, right? And these neutrons are supposed to fission more uranium-235 nuclei. Now, in the bomb, you have comparatively little uranium-238 left, and you have mostly uranium-235. So it's more likely that these neutrons will actually hit uranium-235 than uranium-238. On the other hand, in the reactor fuel, you have mostly still uranium-238, so it's more likely that the nucleus will actually hit uranium-238. That means the product that results from a neutron hitting uranium-238, this product is plutonium, will be more abundant in a reactor mixture of isotopes than in a bomb mixture of isotopes. If you have a true fission bomb, then among the fallout, you should find almost no plutonium. In the reactor, you have quite a bit of plutonium. And what we find in the fallout of the Hiroshima bomb is actually quite a bit of plutonium. Okay, so we have, firstly, very little nuclear fallout in Hiroshima. That's implausibly low. The amount is implausibly low. And the second point is we do find plutonium, which must come from a reactor. The third point is none of the samples actually contains highly enriched uranium. It's only ever very, very weakly enriched, just barely above the level of natural uranium.
So let me sum up, and please correct me if I don't get it wrong. The ground where we were told a nuclear weapon, a fissionable nuclear weapon, was detonated was later tested after the fact. The isotopes of what was found or called radiation were tested, and it proves beyond arguability or beyond dispute that that material had to have come from a reactor and could not have been created by what we call a nuclear warhead. And I guess it also implies that somebody got a suitcase full of it or something and sprinkled it all around so that the testing would find radioactive material.
That's correct. That is correct. Yes. So this is just they clearly tried to fake the fallout. They obviously had precious little of the material at the time. And even this precious little material was only very weakly enriched above background, above natural. So they were really in the infant stages of isotopic enrichment. They were nowhere near where they needed to be for actually building a nuclear weapon. So that's quite clear, yes.
So I'm just going to sidestep for a second just to get this on the record from your point of view. I'm sure you're familiar with a man named Galen Windsor. Yes. So I'm going to ask, and anyone can go look this up, it's supposed or it's claimed that he was within the nuclear community, reactors and all this kind of thing. This man went on a roadshow saying you've been lied to about what's called fissionable or radioactive materials. He ate some of it. He handled it regularly. So let me ask you, do you accept that what Galen Windsor showed the world is correct? Or do you think that he's lying?
No, I do think he was. I don't think he is lying. I mean, he shows it very clearly on stage. I mean, this would be.
Right.
I think there is reason to. It can be understood why eating uranium doesn't actually do so much harm, right, as you might expect. It just simply isn't taking up. Most of it won't be taking up. And uranium-238 is an alpha radiator, so the radiation doesn't have a strong reach. If you inhale this sort of thing, it would actually be more dangerous than if you just lick it and swallow it. So I wouldn't recommend to necessarily to repeat Galen Windsor's experiments, because I think there is a small chance that you will actually induce some sort of biological harm and you really don't have any benefit from eating it that I'm aware of. But I think his point was that the risks of radioactivity have been greatly exaggerated. I think that's the point he wanted to drive home.
And you accept that that's correct?
That is correct. I accept that, yes.
Okay. That's a key point. And by the way, people, and you may not be aware, people are putting up clips all over TikTok and other places where they have found huge numbers of products from, I think, the early 1900s with radium in them, to the point where they're even beginning to claim that many of the old fireplaces were never intended or actually not being used to burn anything, but they were putting radium bricks to heat the house.
What? Oh, no, I don't think so.
But they've got packaging and everything else of all these products that supposedly had radium in them. But the point I'm making is for any of us lay people to even get our hands on any of these materials to try to investigate whether or not it's true, well, most of it's been outlawed and most of it's been hoarded away under lock and key and guard.
Right.
Anyhow, I pulled this a little off track. Can you pull us back around?
Okay. So the story of the isotopes, I mean, I actually ran, I mean, since I'm not a physicist, right? So I tried to get some expert input on this. So I ran this by a very friendly professor of physics who has himself written several books about the nuclear weapons, how they work and this sort of thing. And he admitted to me that he couldn't reconcile the inconsistencies between my findings and the official story. But the funny part was he still insisted, he still continues to believe the official story. Even so, he explicitly admitted to me, I cannot explain these discrepancies. So this was pretty funny. But I mean, I did get expert review on these findings and on my interpretation. So a few other interesting questions here is, I mentioned earlier that the Russians actually taught the Americans how to enrich nuclear isotopes, which was also a pretty funny story. You are aware of the nuclear spies, right? Klaus Fuchs being probably the most important one. So he was a German physicist. He was a member of the Manhattan Project himself, and he apparently passed all the information he could get hold of to the Russians. And he continued to spy for the Russians right up to 1949 or 50, when finally his cover was blown and he was arrested. So the Russians, even so they had received these files, they obviously didn't learn from these files how to enrich uranium. So they actually developed this method themselves. And for this purpose, they had captured a German physicist, Max Steenbeck, who developed, while in Russia, the technique of ultracentrifugation, right? So the enrichment of uranium-235 through gas centrifugation. And in the 1950s, after Stalin's death, Steenbeck and his co-workers, they were released and they moved back to Germany. And then two of his co-workers actually introduced the technique which they had developed in Russia to the Degussa, which was a German enterprise which was working on enriching nuclear fuels. And so the technology then spread from Germany to the United States. So the Americans actually learned from the Russians indirectly how to enrich uranium. And I think this technology, the gas centrifugation, was then later on used for preparing bomb fuel and also reactor fuel for industrial exploitation of nuclear power.
Doesn't that imply what you just stated? Doesn't that imply that the Russians would have been more quickly in a position to actually drop a nuclear bomb, a fissionable weapon, way before the Americans, if what you just said was true?
That is, yes, that's an interesting suggestion. Another point is that Galen Windsor, actually, in one of his interviews, in one of his presentations, he stated that fairly early on. Was it still the 40s or early 50s? At that time, the Americans obviously had managed to purify plutonium. Okay. And the plutonium apparently was shipped, and he suspects it was shipped to Russia. So it was simply loaded on some ships and shipped somewhere. And I mean, where else would it have gone? So it seems that the Americans actually gave the Russians the plutonium, which the Russians then used for their first nuclear bomb test in 1949. That's at least what Galen Windsor's story suggests. But enriching uranium, yes. So in that regard, the Russians would have been in the better position to build a uranium bomb if they had chosen to do so. It's also interesting that in Max Steinbeck's autobiography, this is where I found this information, right? He does not mention the first Russian bomb test at all. He does not discuss it at all. He only ever talks about his own work on enriching uranium, and he does not mention whether the Russians used any of that uranium for their bomb tests, and he doesn't mention the bomb test in 1949, which is supposed to have used plutonium, not uranium.
Do you have any idea what may have actually gone off at the Trinity site?
Well, I didn't spend too much time looking into that. I think it was some sort of elaborate fireworks. Okay. I mean, one aspect that you know from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are these so-called mushroom clouds. If you read eyewitness testimony, then you often find description of these clouds as colorful. So you have different colors, and these colors actually swirl together and this sort of thing. So what this suggests is that they used colored smoke bombs for generating these mushroom clouds. And there is indeed one eyewitness testimony from Hiroshima. One woman reports that a purple colored smoke bomb went off in her living room. The cloud that developed at Alamogordo, New Mexico, was allegedly also colorful, right? So these were just sort of elaborate fireworks. There also was a flash, whether these were photo flash bombs or thermobaric weapons. I have been unable to ascertain. There's precious little information, actually no information, that would really give you a specific clue as to what happened there. And on top of that, they probably also had some big bangs, right? I mean, the official record admits that shortly before the alleged nuclear bomb test, they actually set off a big TNT explosion there.
People did work on that. It was well covered until YouTube began removing all the footage. What was claimed was that two battalions of soldiers were taken, and one battalion was told, you guys are stacking TNT, so we compare it to the other guys who are doing a nuclear explosion. But in essence, what was actually done is both sides stacked hundreds or thousands of pounds of TNT. There were no nuclear armaments, and they were just told an untruth. And as I mentioned before, dynamite can easily create a mushroom cloud.
Right, exactly. And on the other hand, there isn't any reason why a nuclear detonation should create a mushroom cloud.
Oh, is that right?
Why would it? I mean, what should this cloud consist of? What does this cloud consist of? It's either water vapor, right, condensed water vapor, or it is smoke, or it's a mixture of both. Okay, a nuclear weapon doesn't generate water vapor, and there is nothing that gets oxidized. There is simply no substance that could actually form a mushroom cloud. It simply releases heat, right, and a little bit of material, but nothing. There is no matter that could actually form the substance of a mushroom cloud. And also, if you have these black mushroom clouds, what is black? Black is soot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the black soot in a mushroom cloud from TNT simply stems from the incomplete combustion of the carbon in the explosive, right? If you look at the structural formula of TNT, you will find out there simply isn't enough oxidizer to fully oxidize all the carbon. So this is why you have some soot left over. And this gives you the black part of the mushroom cloud. Then in a nuclear detonation, the heat should be so great that everything should be at a white glow, but not a red glow, right? You see in these mushroom clouds, you see red glow. Red glow isn't hot enough for a nuclear detonation. So there really isn't any reason to expect that a true nuclear bomb should produce this kind of smoky, red glowing mushroom cloud. It's totally implausible.
Well, it's a good point. And by the way, I have read descriptions where they claim the nuclear explosion is as hot as the sun. If it was anywhere near that, it should vaporize everything.
Yeah, that's one thing. And also, it should have the color of the sun, right? It should be white. It should be white or bright yellow, but it shouldn't be red. So that's exactly the point.
Well, it's funny. Some of the propaganda, like even now, most people listening are not old enough to remember the propaganda that was put out in this country about nuclear weapons. There was a turtle, a cartoon turtle named Bert, who taught the children how to duck and cover. It is openly called propaganda now. But if you look at that old cartoon, a monkey holds a firecracker or a stick of dynamite above the turtle. So they're showing you right there that conventional explosions were used.
And I suspect that the very name Trinity is a wordplay on TNT.
Oh.
Because the chemical name of TNT is trinitrotoluene.
Huh. That's classic.
I think that's what the name Trinity really comes from. Okay. So, right. So then maybe one more note about the fallout, right? I mean, we have this so-called black rain in going down in Hiroshima, but interestingly not in Nagasaki. Okay. There are some eyewitness accounts that describe this black rain as oily. So what I suspect is that the radioactivity that they dispersed in Hiroshima, it was actually sprayed in an oily suspension from airplanes, right? These eyewitnesses also mention airplanes overhead that they heard, not they didn't see it because the cities were burning and everything was under one big smoke screen, but they heard the airplanes overhead as these black droplets splattered them, okay? So I think they had simply suspended the radioactivity in these oily droplets, and at the same time, it also rained. So they had watery rain at the same time with this oily black rain. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what this was about, I think it was an attempt. So firstly, the watery rain, it was probably induced by cloud seeding, and I'm not sure whether we have enough time to go into the reasons why I think that. But so cloud seeding and the watery rain was probably intended to disguise the oily rain. And the oily rain wasn't disguised. It turned out to be black at the ground, probably simply because the oil droplets, as they were traveling downwards through the smoke clouds, they collected soot. So this made them rather conspicuous. Okay. And I think that is the reason why they didn't try the same trick again in Nagasaki. So there was no black rain in Nagasaki. And the reason why they used these oil droplets in the first place would be that they wouldn't be washed away on the ground by the watery rain. Okay. So the oil would stick to the surface and the precious little radioactivity that they had would then still be detectable on the ground. So the watery rain wouldn't wash it away, but at the same time, the watery rain would disguise it. But that plan didn't really pan out very, very well.
Were you aware, when Jason and I did the research on this, we found out that during the Hiroshima incident, which we assume would be better described as firebombing, there was only one AP reporter. Actually, the Jesuits were on the ground, but there was only one Western AP reporter let in to cover that for the world. That's another angle that a lot of people overlook. So everything that we were told, and he was, what was it, Jason? He was a CIA operative, I think, or had been?
He attended Yale and was a member of the Skull and Bones Secret Society, but he also wrote historical fiction and wasn't just a journalist.
Was he on the ground or was he with the air crews?
He was put in the vicinity before the bombing.
I see. Okay. Right. No, I didn't know that. That's an interesting story. I need to know more about that one. But I mean, you mentioned one term, firebombing. I mean, firebombing was part of it. Yes.
Yes.
But I think there's one important aspect to this firebombing. It seems that in this case, right, in these two cities, the firebombs, the napalm bombs, they were actually detonated in the air. I think that was the actual reason for producing those smoke clouds at the beginning of the attacks, right? So they had these big mushroom clouds very early on in the attacks. All the eyewitnesses say that, right? So you have the mushroom clouds developing very early on in the attacks. I think these were simply intended as smoke screens, firstly, to hide the airplanes, which would deliver all this additional ordnance, right? Napalm and about also mustard gas, as I will discuss in a minute. So through the napalm bombs, I think, into the smoke cloud. So they would detonate within the smoke cloud, and then the napalm would rain down, already burning, onto the city. So in this regard, in this way, these fire bombings in these two cities were indeed somewhat different from the fire bombings in other cities. The bombs were not detonated near the ground, but high up in the air. That is actually supported by several eyewitnesses, right? Several eyewitnesses report that there was some sort of lava raining down from those smoke clouds. So I think this was just simply the burning napalm, which was raining to the ground. And now, another big finding about these two cities, right? I mean, there were numerous reports of so-called radiation sickness from both cities. Okay, so we have to somehow account for this radiation sickness, even though there was hardly any radiation. And it turns out that, again, eyewitness testimony tells us where to look. There are very many eyewitnesses who very explicitly mention poison gas being released in both cities. Okay. And they make explicit connection between the poison gas being released and people being killed, people losing their hair and this sort of thing. So the poison gas which was used there was apparently mustard gas, sulfur mustard. It is known, it has been known for a long time, it was known already since 1919, that mustard gas produced radiation-like effects on the bone marrow and also on other organs. When hair loss is not a novelty, it was also known. So you can actually fake some radiation effects simply by exposing people to mustard gas. And it is known that the Americans actually did have bombs, aerial bombs filled with mustard gas. A ship transporting such bombs was actually blown up in the South Italian port city of Bari in 1943 by a Luftwaffe attack. And many people, particularly also many servicemen, some 80 servicemen, American servicemen, and an untold number of civilians were killed by the mustard gas that was released on that occasion by sinking that ship that had been loaded with mustard gas bombs.
So much for the rules of war, right?
Yeah, I mean, and they're very true. There are also explicit plans from the Americans. They actually planned out, they didn't go through with it in the end, but they planned out the extensive use of mustard gas bombs in preparation for a landing in Japan, right? So instead of just landing outright with all the people there on the beach, they would have first just simply saturation bombed the island and its defensive installation, its remaining defensive installations with mustard gas.
All right, Michael, we're getting ready to wrap up hour one here. We'll take a short break and we'll come back for hour two. Do you have a website or any contact information that you'd like to share? And just to give you fair warning, this is hour one. It goes out everybody. If you don't want to get bombarded, but you want to share information, you'd be better to hold it till hour two.
Okay, no, that's fine. So I have a website, which is mpalmer.heresy.is. And you can find the book there. And within the book, you can find an email address where you can reach me.
Okay. Do you have a login for crow777radio.com?
A login?
Yeah. Can you log in to my web? Okay. So while we're on break, maybe you could send Rose an email with your email address, the username you would like, and the links that you would like us to include. So I'm going to wrap up hour one now. And I'll say a couple things before we wrap up. Recently, and people can go look this up, Bill Maher was talking to Neil Myast Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson was trying to convince Bill Maher that fallout was not part of nuclear weapons. And that's all I'm going to say. You can go look at it. Bill Maher was beside himself because his whole life he'd been told the opposite. But I'm going to say a statement here, which I have used many times for all the people who want nuclear weapons to be real. And here is the statement. There has never been a time when plants, animals, human beings, and drinkable water did not exist in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that one piece of logic alone should tell you the truth of the matter.
Well, I mean, you know, the drinkable water, I doubt that a bit. You know, I think after they had rained down the mustard gas on the city, I think the drinking water that was at least that pools of water that were out in the open, they must have been highly poisonous.
This may be, but the water was not affected in the way that they describe nuclear weapons would affect it.
But it was affected. There's actually an interesting story by Wilfred Burchett, an Australian journalist, who snuck into Hiroshima in early September. And he was told and also shown by the locals that the fish in the river arms, right? Hiroshima is located in the river delta. So the fish in those river arms, they were actually floating in several places. They were still floating belly up weeks after the so-called atomic bomb. So he reported this back to the American military when he was back in Tokyo. And they flat out denied him. No, that cannot be true. You have been lied to. You have been the victim of propaganda and this sort of bullshit, you know? So, I mean, mustard gas actually is an oily fluid, right? So it can simply rain down and it is heavier than water. So if it falls into the river, it will just simply come to rest at the bottom of the water and then it will just simply slowly dissolve. And so this is how the fish most likely were poisoned over time. And the same would have happened to any other pool or puddle or whatever anybody might fetch drinking water from, right? I mean, after the breakdown of the... I mean, you would have to assume, right, that after the bombing, conventional bombing, explosives were actually used as well. I haven't discussed that so much, but okay. So the infrastructure of the city had collapsed, right? So people would probably have fetched their drinking water, at least in some cases, from some open containers, tanks, whatever. And that would have meant they would probably have been poisoned that way.
It's certainly plausible. You know, my first job out of high school, I took care of a 90-year-old man who had been mustard gassed in World War I and was missing a lung. But I've got to wrap up hour one now. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums. They can create forums. They get access to all the comments section. Members can view the film anytime they like. It covers all my telescopic work over about 6 years. And incidentally, I will be starting filming The Sun any day here now when the weather lets up. And that will be posted for members on crow777radio.com to preserve control, freedom of speech, and ownership of said content. With that, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back for hour two. I hope to see everybody out there logged in as a member for hour two. And I would like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Cheers.
is the enemy of knowing.